histories of words because they're interesting, or translation. So there are the Chomskyans that I talked about, but there's another thriving subfield, which is called historical linguistics or diachronic linguistics, which is interested in how we got from there to here. Sometimes people are interested in it because how we got from there to here can shed light on how we speak what's going on here. Some people want to study how we got from there to here for the simple fact that it's rather interesting and that it might shed light on our psychology, or sometimes, just sometimes, on our cultural history. But the study of grammaticalization is one of the more exciting parts of modern historical linguistics. Historical linguistics used to be much more fashionable in linguistics than it is. It was the heart of the field when modern linguistics was established in the 1800s. It's since been somewhat eclipsed by more Chomskyan-oriented paradigms, but there remains a healthy number of people involved in the endeavor. So that's grammaticalization, and that is rebracketing. And in the next lecture, we'll talk about how words' meanings change over time, and that will be about what we often call semantic change.
Lecture 5, How Language Changes, Meaning and Order.
In the past lectures, we've seen how language changes in terms of sounds and in terms of how new pieces of grammar are built. We've seen how language wears away and builds back up at the same time. In this lecture, I want to look at some other things that happen when a language changes, because these are more of the kinds of things that have happened to turn the first language into today's 6,000. So this time, what we want to look at is how words' meanings change over time. And that's apart from grammaticalization. Words' meanings can change in different ways. And we also want to look at word order, because that varies in languages a lot more than we might think just looking at French and Spanish and German. And it has a lot to do with how one language becomes another one, or how one language can become 6,000. So the first part is going to be about meaning. Linguists and philosophers often call this semantics. And so we could say that we're talking about semantic change. Now, as far as semantic change goes, it helps to understand it by thinking of a relatively present day example. So there was an old radio show, the Jack Benny Show, and this is a random example. I'm just kind of pulling this out of my head. At one point, the band leader on the show, whose name was Phil Harris, who was kind of a randy fellow, is talking to his wife, who was Alice Faye, who was a singer and movie star at the time. And at one point, and it's sometime in the 40s, he says, "Come on, baby, admit it. Nobody makes love better than me, huh?" And that's on the radio show. Now, to the modern ear, that's a little shocking. It almost sounds like he's talking about something very intimate. You wouldn't expect that on a national radio show in the 1940s. And, of course, that's not what he meant. As late as the 1940s, the term "make love" actually meant just, perhaps, kissing, or even just dropping a handkerchief in front of someone or coming on to them. But it didn't have the particular meaning that it does now. The meaning of make love has changed gradually over the years. So it was different even for our grandparents. That is a kind of process that happens to all kinds of words in any language over time. And you can imagine that if you're dealing with more than a few decades or a half century, then you can see a great deal of considerable turnover. So we often, in the present tense, are a little bit uncomfortable seeing how the meanings of words change. We feel that there's a meaning set in the dictionary, and then to the extent that usage starts to drift away from this, something wrong has happened. That's a natural feeling. But we gain some perspective on that when we look at what has happened to a great many words in a language over time. And so the process is often one that we could call semantic drift. And this refers to the simple fact that the meaning of a word, the correspondence between a word and what real-world entity or process it's linked to, tends to drift over time. It can drift in many directions. Often it seems almost random, although from one point to another there's always a kind of logical connection. But this is something that happens to words. Language is messy. Here's an example of this. The word silly. The word silly to us means foolish, and it's a very ordinary word. But what's interesting is that in earlier English, silly just meant blessed. In Old English, it meant that somebody was blessed. And for those of you who know German, you'll remember the word selig, which is S-E-L-I-G. It's the same root, and selig means blessed in German. So there was selig in German, and that's blessed. And then in English, there was silly, and that meant blessed. They were cognates. But something happened to our word silly in English based on a series of steps. So as late as 1400, you can find tokens of English in which silly still means blessed. And to imagine it meaning what we think of as silly would make the sentence make no sense. And so, for example, in 1400, one quotation from English is, in modern pronunciation, "Silly art thou, holy Virgin Mary." And nobody would call the Virgin Mary silly, most likely. They mean that she's blessed. Now, what happens is that words drift in their meaning. So, as it happens, if you're blessed, then chances are that you're innocent, or at least it implies that. And so, by the time we get well into the Middle Ages, the word silly means innocent. And so you get sentences such as in 1470, "Silly Scotland that of help has great need." Certainly not foolish Scotland. No particular reason why it would be blessed Scotland. You might think that Scotland was blessed, but really what this means in the context is that Scotland is innocent. It's a country that has a subordinate, it's a region that has a subordinate relationship to England, particularly in this time, and therefore silly Scotland, innocent Scotland, Scotland that didn't do anything. But this drifting keeps going. There's no reason why it would only be in one step. If something is innocent, then it tends to elicit compassion. And so there's a meaning of deserving of compassion that comes along. By 1633, you see silly used in sentences like, "Thou only art the mighty God, but I a silly worm." Now, this is a rather lofty kind of context, and so to call oneself a kind of a ding-dong worm would not fit the tone. What the silly meant was, please have compassion upon me, kind of like Scotland. And so, I am a silly worm. And so, then, the fact is that if you deserve compassion, and this is something which is a great problem in human affairs, there's a fine line between deserving compassion, eliciting compassion, and seeming weak. And as a result, by the 1600s, you have a weak meaning for silly. And then there's a fine line between weak and being kind of a dingbat, and hence our meaning for silly. So step by step, a word that meant blessed now means foolish. And at no point did anybody notice some sort of major shift going on. It went step by step, generation by generation. And so this means that Shakespeare can throw us sometimes in his use of the word silly. For example, in The Two Gentlemen of Verona, which dates to 1591, at one point Valentine says, "I take your offer and will live with you, provided that you do no outrages on silly women or poor passengers." Now today we hear it as kind of some sort of knock on women. And an actor might render it that way. It implies some sort of residual sexism in this arcane character. Shakespeare didn't mean that. He actually meant that the women deserved compassion, that they deserved help, just like the poor passengers. It was a rather nice sentence on silly women and poor passengers. Because of semantic drift over time, and there's certainly been quite a bit of time between Shakespeare and us, we find little false friends like that. So silly has been through quite a trip, and it is a typical example of how words evolve in terms of their meaning through time. So that's an example of semantic drift. Nice is another word like that. You will read in older sources, And even today, in residual expressions, nice used to mean fine. So, for example, let's not make nice distinctions. We might kind of just let that go by in our heads, but our core meaning for nice is pleasant, well-intended, socially companionable. So what then is a nice distinction? That goes back to the original meaning of nice, which is that something is subdivided finely. So then you have niceties, and you might think that niceties such as an antimacassar or some sort of sauce on your asparagus is a nicety because, well, it's nice. But that's not really what it means. It's actually something fine. You might want to just eat your asparagus steamed and it's just sitting there. You might want to put something on your asparagus, and some people would think that was kind of pretentious, but that's a finer distinction. That's more specific. You don't want just any old food. You want the asparagus with the hollandaise sauce. It's a nicety. So we preserve it there. Reading Jane Austen or reading through Middlemarch, you can see examples of nice used in that way of making fine distinctions. The word has since evolved, and because those fine distinctions often do create a positive feeling, it is kind of nice. And so now we have that meaning of nice. It didn't used to be that way. So that's what words do. And of course, imagine not just a word, but a whole language full of words with all or most of them undergoing this kind of shift. That's what a language does through time. So you have the first language, then as you get to the 6,000, a lot of the difference between those 6,000 among themselves, and also the difference between the 6,000 and the first one, is due to the fact that words do this, whether we like it or not. There is also, more specifically, something called semantic narrowing. And semantic narrowing is what happens when words develop more specific meanings than the ones that they start out with. This often happens. And so, for example, meat in Old English meant all food. And so meat could refer to something sweet. Meat could refer to a gumball. They didn't have gumballs, but you take my point. That's what meat meant. As time went by, meat came to refer to animal flesh, and that just happened. And as usual, at the margins of the language, the old form survives in some way. So, for example, sweet meat is fruit and candy. It is not horse meat and lamb. But we think to ourselves, well, why is it meat? And then we get on with our lives. But the reason is because that word formed when meat could be anything that you put into your mouth and ate. Then there's semantic broadening, on the other hand. Semantic broadening is when a word becomes more general than what it used to refer to. So the Old English word bird, which was actually brid, only referred to young birds. And so it was kind of like our birdie to the extent that it implies a young bird. And then the word for birds in general was Vogel. And for German fans out there, that is like German's Vogel. And so, again, German and English were more akin in the past than they are now in terms of things like this. As it happened, Brid, their word for bird, semantically broadened to refer to all birds, and Vogel became fowl, which refers today only to game birds, or if anything is a rather precious word for bird. And so that's a semantic broadening. So words are going through that kind of process all the time. And as a result, when you look at the vocabulary that our language consists of, what we can see is the endless products at this particular point in time of this sort of thing happening in millions of mouths over a great many years. So we could even trace it back. Proto-Indo-European, which we'll learn about more shortly in the series, is the language that was the parent to not only English and German and its friends, but also French and Spanish and Italian and the other Romance languages and Russian and Polish and Bulgarian and the other Slavic languages. Most of the languages of Europe trace back to an ancestor that linguists call Proto-Indo-European. We only can reconstruct what it must have been like, but we're pretty confident about certain things. And one thing that we know about Proto-Indo-European is that there was a word in it, bear, which meant to carry or to bear children. The core meaning was to carry. It was technically a root because Proto-Indo-European, like Latin, like Spanish, had endings. And so bear wouldn't have occurred alone. There would have been I bear, you bear, etc. But the root was bear. Bear comes down to English in a wide range of meanings, but not just in this meaning of to bear children, and certainly not in terms of to carry. It's there, but it's disguised in a way because it's undergone semantic drift of all kinds, not to mention narrowings and broadenings. So, for example, we bear a nuisance because toleration is a kind of carrying. And so there's an inference there that has come to be part of the language. The bare root also goes through sound changes. So remember, this is always happening too, along with the meaning change. And so what one bears is not a bearden, but it's a burden. And so that burr comes from this original bear. Then there's a narrowing. Some people would argue that to give birth is something of a burden. And so there you have birth. The B-I-R is from bear. So you've got, I'll bet you never thought about the fact that that T-H is a suffix. You've got warm, warmth. You've got sloth, sloth, sloth. That's where that came from. And then you have foul and filth. Those came from, those are related in that way. You have bear, you have birth, and then sound changes it to birth. And so that's how that word works. Then there was what bear went through when sometimes it kludged onto other words. And this is something which we've seen is very common, and so there's no exception with bear. Often, Proto-Indo-European speakers would combine bear with this other verb, enk. Enk meant to get to reach. And so if you bear enked something, so to speak, then you carried something with the aim of getting it somewhere. In other words, this was bringing. And notice that if you say berenk together, and you imagine what happens when people are saying berenk, bring, 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 pretty soon you've got this word bring. Bring starts out as these two words, and it comes together. That's from berenk. And you'd never think about the fact that bring has this little piece in its skeleton, which is the same root that makes birth and burden or even bear. But that's the way it worked. And of course, it's not that bear is some sort of trick word. This is just normal. This is what happens to words over time. So berenk became bring, just like all one became alone, as we saw in a previous lecture. So that happened to bear. Now then, we can pull the camera back again and remember that bear originates in Proto-Indo-European, although we can assume that it goes back further than that. But for our purposes, it's there. Now, what happened in English was one thing, but bear also percolated into all the other languages that Indo-European involves. It bears mentioning, for example, that Indo-European, and this is a preview because we're going to talk more about this pretty soon, is a family that extends across most of Europe, with just a few exceptions. Then we come through the Fertile Crescent region, and it is most of the languages of Iran, and it carries us all the way through to India here. So, Indo-European is a big family. Notice that as the world goes, it's just one of a great many, and on this map, only the families are marked in pretty colors that we're going to discuss in this series. But the world is covered with families. There is quite a mess of them, for example, here in New Guinea and in Australia, and don't even get me started on South America. So, this orange spread is just one of many, but we're talking about Indo-European. And what happened in English, of course, only happened in this one lonely little place. So what about in these other places? An example would be what happened with Latin. And so Proto-Indo-European has bear. In Latin, for various reasons, that root changed into, for example, ferre, which means to carry. And ferre, that happened in Latin. Then later on, English borrowed a lot of words from Latin. And so we've got all of these words with the children of ferre in them, which trace back to bear, just like our bear words do. And so transfer and prefer, those are from ferre, which goes back to bear. And those involve carrying mostly in a transparent way, so transferring. As far as prefer, the meaning of the word has changed so much that we can only figure it out by tracing it back, and prefer is just a word to us. It doesn't involve carrying. And then there is fertile, and once again, that's carrying. So you can bear a child, you can be fertile. Who knew that when you say bear and fertile, in a way, you're saying the same word? It's because of how languages not only change within, but the way they borrow from each other. Greek, which is another branch of Indo-European, inherited bear as pherein. And then you have pheromone. You have paraphernalia, which you carry around. You have amphorae, which is a pretentious word for bottles. And it's because you carry things in bottles. So amphorae. So this is a common tendency that one sees in language change. And it's something that makes the first language into several others, and in a less tidy, but I think in some ways more interesting fashion than we might always intuitively think. And that is that there is always semantic change. Words, meanings tend to drift around. At no point is there no systematic meaning within a language, but at all points the words' meanings are changing. So that's semantic change, and then while that's going on, you also see changes in word order. And what I mean by word order is a concept that we want to lock into our heads. There are many languages in the world, of which English is one, that use what linguists call SVO order. And what that means is subject, verb, object. Now in school, we probably were exposed to the subject predicate paradigm. So you've got half of this in your head already, subject. Linguists talk about predicates, but not as much as they talk about two elements of the predicate, which is the verb and the object. Of all the things you can think of that are interesting in a language, linguists have this fetish about the object. And so subject, verb, object. So the boy kicked the ball. And that is an SVO sentence. English is an SVO, subject, verb, object, language. If you are an English speaker, and sometimes even if you are just a logician, nothing seems more logical than to start with the subject, then mention what it did, and then mention what it did, whatever it was doing, too. But as it happens, SVO is not the most common word order in the world. Generally, most often, by a hair or two, a language is going to be SOV, which is a language where you have subject, object, verb. So for us, we think of German as kind of cute in tending to put the verb at the end. And so the boy has his first alcoholic drink had, or something like that. And we think, well, how quaint. Actually, how normal. Many languages are that way. So in Turkish, for example, if Hasan buys an ox, if Hasan bought an ox, then Hasan the ox bought. Hasan ökizü aldı. And so Hasan did not buy the ox. If you're a Turk and you've never been exposed to English, the weirdest thing about English at first to you is this business of putting the verb in the middle of the sentence. And that's true across a great many places in the world. If you're a linguist and you are studying an undocumented language, you are as open to it being SOV, subject, object, verb, as it being SVO. If anything, SVO is kind of the boring one. It's kind of, we know, we have that from English. It's going to be interesting. It's going to have a different word order. That's part of the fun. Then there are languages where the verb comes first. For example, Welsh and its Celtic relatives, like Irish Gaelic, Scots Gaelic, Breton, are verb-first languages. And so they are VSO, as linguists call them, verb, subject, object. That's also true of languages of Polynesia, like Samoan and Tongan. And this is very ordinary in these languages to have the verb come first. Those of you with the book can see the Welsh example with Alan seeing the dog. It used to be that it was thought that still there were limits. If you've got S, V, and O, then there's six possible combinations. And it used to be thought that one of them that you would never find, it was thought just to be too wacky, would be OVS, object, verb, subject. One thing to put the verb first, but object, verb, subject, it was thought unlikely. But there is a language in South America, and it's not the only one, which was discovered, where that actually is the default order. One of them has a nice name, Hishkaryana, and it's spoken by a very small group of people. And if you have an ordinary sentence, like the man took the canoe, then it's canoe took person. And so kanawa yano toto is canoe took person. And that's the normal way that they speak. If a Hishkaryana-speaking monolingual were brought into quote-unquote civilization, then one of the first things they'd have to learn is that people in civilization talk backwards, and that's because word order can be like that. Now, what's important about word order is that it's also central in how languages change, just like how meaning changes. So these word orders tend to change in languages over time. There is a minor debate as to whether or not the first language would have been SOV or SVO. By my reckoning, the jury is out. Either one could be plausible. But we know that languages change their word order over time, and so whatever the first word order was, there are now certainly a great many languages that have a different word order. For example, Old English had a word order system similar to Germans. And so if you were learning Old English, then one thing you would have to get used to is that our good old-fashioned meat and potatoes SVO order was only one option, and that you pretty much had to master the German way of putting things together. So something along the lines of he had seen the boy would very likely be he had the boy seen in Old English. That's because, again, English and German were more similar back in English's earlier days. Biblical Hebrew and modern Hebrew are essentially different languages. One reason that they are is that Biblical Hebrew put the verb first. Modern Hebrew is SVO, like modern English. The word order changed over time. Now, one little factoid. Often a linguist says that languages can be of any word order and the order changes over time. There is a little more. There's a little mystery that comes up every now and then, which is that watching a language go from SOV to SVO is common. So very often a language that puts its verbs on the end ends up putting its verbs in the middle. If from an ethnocentric perspective, it is common to see languages go from SOV to what we can't help but process as normal. And there are even some analyses that suggest that there is something normal about SVO, and that everything else is something that might happen but is somehow not stable. And the fact is that seeing a language go from SVO to SOV, a language starting to put its verbs on the end, is very, very rare, except in situations where people who speak an SVO language for one reason or another start speaking an SOV language to the point that the SOV language starts to affect this original one. So then you will see that kind of change. But if the people are just going on about their business and there's no kind of heavy influence of some outside language upon the language, languages that are SVO have a way of not becoming SOV. There are various answers as to why that would be, but it's not, none of them are firm, and it's kind of a mystery at this point. So that's just an observation. But there are also languages that have no set word order at all. The classic example of this is a language called Walapuri in Australia. And in Walapuri, you could have a sentence, the small child is chasing the dog. And there's really no order at all. You can have those elements in any order that you want. You could say, dog is chasing child small. You could say, chasing is dog the child small. You can even say, child is chasing small the dog, with the small and the child separated from each other. And this is just the way these people talk. It's not a personality trait. There's nothing loopy about the Walapuri speakers. It's just that their language does this. One thing that helps it along is that Walapuri is a language kind of like Latin, where you have suffixes to indicate whether something is an object or, depending on how you put it, a subject. And so you can get away with shuffling things around because it's always clear what contribution it's making to the sentence. It's not even that simple, though, because there are some languages in the world, I'm aware of a few in Southeast Asia, where they don't have these kinds of endings, and yet word order is very, very free. The fact of the matter is that context can take care of quite a bit, and to have an actual word order is nice, but in many situations it's not absolutely necessary, especially in the context of running speech, where it's always tied to a context as opposed to something that's disembodied on the page. So, We've seen that semantic change is crucial in how languages go from stage A to stage B and eventually become new languages. And we've seen that word order is not as static as we might think, that the order of words is always changing in most cases, and that there are a great many different kinds of orderings that there can be. And so what this means is that when we talk about language in this course, to recapitulate what I think is an important point, we don't only mean the words. The words are great, and of course, structure without the words would be a rather tiresomely abstract concept. That would not be a useful language. But when we talk about language, the words is one thing, but the sounds and the grammar and meanings are just as important, because neat things happen to those things too. And these things are always changing. So of course, part of what happens to a language is that words drop out and words come back in. But in a way, that's kind of ordinary. So there was a medieval instrument called a shawm. We don't have shawms anymore, so big surprise, that word dropped out of the language. There is now something called, what's something that's new? There's electronic messaging. Nobody even 15 years ago would have known what in the world that is. Now we have that new expression because we have that new thing. Okay, that's nice. But what is really interesting is that if you take a word in a language, for one thing, its sounds are always changing. So really, in a way, when I look at a word in a language, I think, especially if it's not a word that exists in a highly written language, a word is kind of in danger in a way. It can't stay the way it is. Things are going to get worn away. Things are going to get distorted. It can't stay that way for long. It's like a cloud blowing through the sky. So the first thing that happens to a word is that if it hangs around, words like get, words like bring, now that it's a combination of two things, who knows what could happen to bring as time went on, the sounds are wearing away. The mountain is being worn away by the winds. Then in the meantime, its meaning is probably going to be distorted over time, and that's just a natural process as words go through time. In the meantime, if it's a concrete word, it may, especially if it's certain a kind of concrete word, change into a grammatical word over time, which is almost always going to involve being heavily eroded phonetically as well. That word might just become a prefix or a suffix as time goes by, like that little word enk to get to in Proto-Indo-European did when it kludged onto bear and became bring. And so what this means is that language, as I've often written, is like a lava lamp, one of those lava lamps from the 1970s. And so it's not that a language is marching towards some kind of ideal. It's not that a language is slowly going to the dogs. A language is like that, the blob in those lamps. And so at one point it's like that, and another point it's like that, then this little thing pulls off, but then it goes and sticks to something else. And at no point would you say, what's going on in the lava lamp now is somehow better than what was going on 10 minutes ago. It's always just variations on the same thing, which was why it was so mesmerizing to watch them for maybe 5 or 10 minutes if you didn't have anything else to do. That is what language change is like, endless morphings. So in the next lecture, we will take a closer look at these sorts of things in a language with which we were once familiar.
Lecture 6, How Language Changes, Many Directions.
We've seen how one language becomes another one. This time, we're going to look at how one language becomes several, because the truth is that that is the more common process than one language just turning into another one by itself. So we've looked at how assimilation and consonant weakening and vowel weakening and sound shift in particular can change words over time. So far, we've seen A become B. But the truth is, in understanding why so many languages cover the planet, we are actually faced most of the time with a group of languages having started as one, with the changes that we've talked about, the kinds of changes happening to take place differently along the pathway to each new language. So we've seen the general processes, but like I mentioned at one point before, you can only know to a certain extent what is going to happen in the specific sense. And so there's certain predictions you can make, there's certain probabilities, but they're not definite. There are many choices. So for example, the sound th, which is written th in English. As languages go, that sound is not extremely common, and usually if it arises, eventually it's going to go away and turn into something else. But you can't be sure what th is going to turn into. If you see it in a language, you know it's fragile. You know it probably won't be around for too long. But what it's going to turn into, we're not sure. So for example, in some vernacular American Englishes, like Brooklynese, it turns into something like a T sound. And so, for example, Ralph Cramden on The Honeymooners might say, dem tings, instead of things. You know, Norton, dem tings. And so, t, that's what happened to th. Then on the other hand, if you are a Cockney person, then often it becomes an F sound. And so, dem things. So, things ain't what they used to be. That kind of thing. That's what happens to th. You know it's fragile, but what's going to happen to it? Well, there are various things that probably won't. It's not going to turn into a b, but it might turn into a t or a f or a s, etc. So, multiply that by all the sounds in the language, and you can imagine how you can get from many different, you can get from one point to not only point B, but C, D, E, F, G, H, and I. And those will be different languages. So, to wit, often it has arisen that speakers of one language migrate in different groups to different places, and in each place, language change, which cannot be stopped, happens, but in different ways, because it's going to happen in different ways in each place. After a certain period of time, all the people in each place no longer speak the original language. They're speaking what are different languages. Usually by then, that first language has died out for one reason or another, and you've just got these new languages that are akin, but are definitely not the same thing. So this particularly happens when people move around, and so it's become especially common for many new families to form since the Neolithic period when humans started, for one thing, fostering agriculture, which creates more people because more people survive, and then ends up creating population pressure, which leads people to need to move and far enough away to lose contact with the original group. If that happens many times, then chances are eventually you're going to get many different languages. That's proposed as what happened with Indo-European. People moved into Europe, and they also moved eastward of that, and the result was a whole bunch of new languages where there had once existed only one, or maybe one with very different dialects. We'll talk about that. But one example of this was Latin. Latin starts out as just a language that's spoken in what is now Italy. Latin was one of many Indo-European languages. Latin was one of a little cluster of languages called Italic. None of them live today except Latin. But Latin was just one of the bunch. Just like today, Spanish is one of the bunch of Romance languages. Latin was just one of the bunch. And it happened that the peoples who ended up creating the Roman Empire spoke this language, which was Latin. And so Latin ended up moving around a lot more than the typical language did or even does today. The Roman Empire was relatively unique in that the Romans, as they spread far beyond their original boundaries, had a mission to spread Romanness to an extent. And this included, to an extent, imposing their language on other people. That was a relatively new thing at the time. One can be an empire without having any particular concern with whether or not your subjects speak your language. And throughout human history, it has very often been the case that there was no concern with that. So, as counterintuitive as it can be today, there was once a Persian empire. So what we know of now as Iran used to be a major geopolitical player in the world, and the Persian Empire extended westward all the way to the shores of Greece and a considerable degree eastward of what is now Iran. Persian remained spoken in Iran. If subjects were brought to what was then called Persia, Then they probably learned Persian. But as far as the Persian Empire in Babylonia or the Persian Empire anywhere else, Persian was not spoken. It was only used for very official purposes, and the Persian rulers accommodated to the languages that were used in those places. And even the common coin language was Aramaic, which is not related to Persian. The Persians had no interest in seeing everybody speak Persian. The Romans were different in this way. So they were interested in spreading Latin around. So, as Latin spread to various Western European and Eastern European locations, it was imposed upon people who were speaking other languages, but more to the point, suddenly Latin was spoken over this vast region. And of course, forget radio and TV. Once you've got Latin in what was then Gaul, then these are people speaking Latin completely separately from the people speaking it down in Italy. And really, never the twain shall meet in any real way. So this means that Latin is now not only developing from point A to point B in Italy, but then you've got Latin doing that same thing in Gaul, in Spain, not to mention other parts of Italy, in Romania. And so the point is that you start having new Latins. Latin is developing in different directions in each place. Now, one knows that once that process is started, if you fast forward, what you're going to have is Latins that are so different from each other that they're new languages. And that's exactly what happened to create what we now know as the Romance languages. So the big five are French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, and Romanian. And the five of them give great evidence of being related. If you learn one, another one is pretty easy. Spanish and Portuguese are so similar that they almost feel like dialects of the same thing. But they are all basically different languages. We can think about how Latin became them just by looking at one word. So, for example, the word for grass in Latin was herba. And so H-E-R-B-A, herba. It's our English word for herb with an A at the end, herba. Now, that same word exists in French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, and Romanian, but in evolved remnants where sound change has gotten its hands on the word and created a different rendition in each language. And as a result, we have a kind of a variety. So in French, it's herbe. In Spanish, it's yerba. In Italian, it's erba. In Portuguese, it's erva. In Romanian, it's yarba. And so all of these words, even when you just hear them, are clearly related, but they're different. So for example, Latin had herba, which began with an H. But in all five of these Romance languages, the H is gone. The H drops off. Now, French and Spanish keep it in the spelling. So French spells herbe, H-E-R-B-E, but the H hasn't been pronounced for a very long time. Spanish has yerba, but the H is long gone. H is fragile. H has a way of disappearing in languages. And so there's the Pygmalion, My Fair Lady obsession with poor Eliza dropping her H's and saying oss instead of horse. She's typical in this worldwide. If you see H's at the beginnings of words, chances are that H is fragile and that in some closely related language, those H's aren't going to be there. Or if you actually deal with speakers of the language, you find they often drop the H's. H is fragile. So that happened with Latin to the Romance languages. So there's no h in any of them, and so we're just left with the erba. Then from language to language, stuff happened. Italian of the five is the closest to Latin. Italian is what's called a conservative language. It hasn't gone along as far in its changes as some of the others, such as particularly French and Romanian. So Latin was herba. Italian dropped the H, like a good Romance language does. But other than that, it's still got erba. And so an Italian wouldn't have much trouble talking to one of their ancestors from the Roman Empire in that sense. It would just sound like a sloppy version of herba. Other languages, though, have gone a little bit further. So French, it's herbe. And that means that not only did they drop the H, but they dropped the A at the end. Now, it's spelled with an E at the end, but that E is not really pronounced. It's rather like our silent E. It's just gone. Then you have in Portuguese, instead of erba, like Italian, erva. Now, the B changed into a V. Now, this is another one of those alphabet things. In the alphabet, B is up near the beginning, and V is way down at the end. But in real life, if you think about it, B and V are kind of related in terms of how you pronounce them in the mouth. And just like a t will often become a d, so you can feel a d as kind of a version of a t, just with a little bit more belly in it, as I sometimes put it. A b often is going to become a V. There's a relationship. For those of you who know Spanish, you think about the fact that there's that pronunciation of B as V in many Spanish dialects. That's not an accident. So, erva, in Portuguese, it's erva. So from herba to erva. Spanish and Romanian do funny stuff with the vowels. And so in Spanish, the E has become a ye. And so you have yerba instead of the erba of Italian. Romanian, which is, as always, charmingly bizarre, has gone even further. And so instead of e te ye, it's e te ya. So talk about the great vowel shift where the vowels just lurch and change. This is another one of those things. So ya. And then instead of a at the end, herba, erba, it's made into a kind of a schwa-y indistinct sound. So we have about. What is that? Is it an A, E, I, O, or U in terms of how it's said? Really, it's this muddy, crummy little sound. Lemon. What's that last vowel? Ugh, it's just that. Well, same thing. So, yarba. And so that's the word for grass in Romanian. So all of that goes back to herba. And so we have elb, yerba, erba, erva, and yarba, all from this original herba. So that kind of change happens to every word in the language. Very few words in any of these languages trace back to Latin in anything like an unbroken form. And as a result, you have what's obviously a new language. None of the people who speak these five languages could just make their way in Latin. They'd have to learn it in school. A Latin speaker who listened to any of them would find themselves baffled if they could get any of it. They would think something had gone very terribly wrong, but there couldn't be a conversation. These are brand new languages. So, that's how one word becomes five, from Latin to the Romance languages. Now, the fact is that the same thing happens not only with words, but with the structure of the language. And so we go back to the issue of grammar, as opposed to just isolated words. So, for example, we could take a classical Latin sentence. Let's take a sentence like, let's say that you were going to give some object or present to a woman. The way that you would render this in Latin in a pretty normal way would be feminae id dedi, and that's to woman it I gave. Feminae id dedi. So that's the sentence. Now that's the way it was in Latin, and that's one stage of this language, but now we've got these new five stages: French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, and Romanian. And of course, that sentence comes out very differently in each of them. So in French, it's je l'ai donné à la femme. And then in Spanish, it's se lo di à la mujer. And then in Italian, it's l'ho dato alla donna. In Portuguese, it's ho dato a mulher. And in Romanian, it's am dato femei. Now, even if you don't happen to be familiar with any of those five, you can see these are all very different languages. And so, these are not languages that a person who spoke Latin would understand, nor are these people conversant in Latin. Well, how did you get from one place to the other? Well, it was through the kinds of changes that we've seen, except they take place differently in each language. Some of the changes take place in one or two, but not the other three, and so on. The result being this, if you will, diversity among the languages. And so, for example, Latin was a language where you had endings on the end of nouns to indicate how they were used in the sentence. And so, femina is woman. Feminae was to a woman. So that meant that there didn't need to be used a separate word for to the way we do in English. To say to the woman, you just had feminae. So feminae id dedi, to the woman it I gave. Now, in most of the Romance languages, these endings on nouns have worn away. And as a result, you have to have something to indicate that it's to the woman, and so you get the separate word. If you're familiar with the French or Spanish, then you know that that word tends to be a. So where Latin had feminae, in French you have to have à la femme. In Spanish, à la mujer. Romanian, peculiar in its marvelous way, as always, happens to have kept that ending, and so it's femei. But Romanian has many, many, many fewer endings of this kind than Latin did. There's no Romance language that preserves those endings in anything but essentially fragments. So that's one of the differences. And as a result, although the correlation between word order and these endings is not perfect, as we saw with Walpuri versus the Southeast Asian languages where there's no particular word order but no endings, still there's a correlation, and it means that word order in the Romance languages is more regular than in Latin. In Latin, feminae id dedi is one way you could put it, but you could say, for example, id feminae dedi, you could say dedi id feminae, and everything was okay because you had a lot of clues as to how these things fit together. That is less true in the Romance languages. And so, in Spanish, se lo di a la mujer. You can't have something like se mujer di lo a. That doesn't work. You have to have things in a certain order, much less flexible. And that's because of the way the languages have changed over time, and particularly the loss of those useful endings. Then there are other things. Words drop out, words come back. Dedi is, well, a better example here is femina. Latin has femina for woman, but only French and Romanian preserve femina as woman in the pure sense. Italian has femina, but it has a particular meaning. The default word for woman would be donna. And then in Spanish there's mujer, and Portuguese has mulher. So words often replace each other that way as time goes by. So some of the languages keep femina, some of them have shed that for other words. That's a typical kind of difference. Even in terms of grammar, things change. Dedi means I gave. It's a past marked form of give. It's also irregular. If you look at French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, and Romanian, actually, it's only in Spanish and Portuguese that the words for I gave come right from dedi, although, of course, with sound change. So in Portuguese, it's dei with that second D gone, and in Spanish, it's eroded even further to just D. But those go back to dedi. But in French and Italian and Romanian, there's been a change in the way past is often marked. And people who've taken French remember the passé composé. And so it's j'ai donné, I have given, except in French, that doesn't mean what it means in English. It also means I gave. So j'ai donné, instead of one word like di or de in Portuguese to indicate it. That's something that's happened in some Romance languages and not in others, and so it creates a very different grammar. Classical Latin didn't have a perfect along the lines of j'ai donné. It's something that developed gradually as Latin turned into the Romance languages. So, it's common that languages develop new ways of indicating the past, just like grammars develop new ways of indicating the future, as we saw with the way Latin developed the future endings that we see in Italian, and also plurality and all sorts of things. And then, in general, you get new words from old ones. So there's been grammaticalization, which you can see from the difference between feminae e dedi and these other things. Notice that it's just to woman. There's no word for the in classical Latin. You didn't need to say it. And the fact is, a language does not need a the. We're so used to a book, the book, and when we learn another language, one of the first things we're thinking is, where's the, where's a? But actually, a great many languages in the world don't have the and a. For example, Russian, which all of us would agree is a very sophisticated language, does not have a and does not have the. And so Chekhov, Tolstoy, these are written without any of those words. And yet, the point is gotten across. Actually, it's only about a fifth of the world's languages that have both a word for the and a word for a. English happens to be one of them. Europe has kind of a the, a fetish. But around the world, that's not really all that common. And Latin did not have that. And Latin was a very precise language. The developed from words meaning things like that. And so you might say something like that child, and you're kind of distinguishing that child from many others. And in the same way, the child does that. So the child that I saw yesterday. Well, I'm talking about the child. If you hear somebody say that, presumably the child has been brought up before. The child hasn't been brought up, then you say, I'm talking about a child. Now, that's a very persnickety distinction. You could get along being a human being without specifying that. It's kind of nice. English happens to have it. So do the Romance languages. But that starts with the word for that. And so there were certainly words for that in Latin. There are no languages that don't have good old-fashioned demonstratives, this and that. And gradually, the meaning started to soften. And so instead of it being something concrete, as in that chifarobe or something like that, it just became the chifarobe, the one that we happened to mention, a certain semantic shade that we didn't need to make explicit, but languages have a way of climbing into little semantic spaces that might be filled, just like the cat climbs up onto something just because it's there and finds a plant and eats your begonia as lunch. You know, it just does it because it can. In the same way, grammar does that. And so, we are a language that has these uhs and thes, and so are the Romance languages. So, la femme. Latin didn't know from la femme. There was no such thing as that. But in French, you have to have something like that. And so, la femme, la mujer, la donna, and so on. So, the development of these articles is something that happened from the pathway from Latin to Romance. And so, articles developed because of this grammaticalization. So that's another thing that distinguishes Latin from all of its what we call daughter languages. And then those articles are different from language to language. So the masculine one in French is le, then in Spanish it's el, and in Italian it's il, then in Portuguese it's just o, and in Romanian it's ul, and it comes after the noun instead of before it. And so omul instead of ul om. That was for a reason. We'll get to that. But there's great diversity among these descendants. So Latin no longer exists, or more properly, Latin exists, but it's in all of these different forms. It evolved into different things. German and English and Swedish and Yiddish are all related in the same way. They are descended from an ancestor that is not explicitly documented, but which we call Proto-Germanic. Proto-Germanic is long gone, but it's not really, because in a way I'm speaking it. This is one of the descendants of it. At no point was there any break. It's just that Proto-Germanic is very different from what it used to be. And it's the same thing with Russian and Polish and Bulgarian. There was a Proto-Slavic. We don't quite know what it looked like, but we know that it existed and we can reconstruct words. So this is a general process. Now, so often in the old language books, there are these general processes discussed, and it only seems to have happened in Europe. And part of the reason for that is because most was known about those languages at the time. It was a different time. Multiculturalism was not something that was terribly important, even to most academics. We live in a different time, and I don't want to only show these things using the same old French, Spanish, and Italian, because it tends to lend a certain impression that we're talking about Europe or languages that we're familiar with, that it's something specific. This is everywhere, and so let's take a look at the same thing, or actually, let's restate that sentence without sounding like Henry Aldrich. Let's take a look at the same sort of process in Chinese, because it's not something that only happens in Latin. So, the Chinese languages are as different from one another as the Romance languages. Often it's said that Chinese comes in different dialects, and generally somebody mentions Mandarin and Cantonese. That's very misleading, because dialect implies that they are mutually intelligible, or that they're somehow pretty much the same, and they are not. The Chinese dialects are every bit as different as the Romance languages. If you grow up speaking Cantonese, Mandarin is not a matter of wrapping your ear around an accent and learning some new words. You have to learn it in school. They're completely different. And so, depending on how you count it, there are seven Chinese languages in the principal sense. And so Mandarin and Cantonese we've all heard of. Then there is what we can call in the folk sense Taiwanese, although that is also the Fujianese that's spoken on the mainland. That's a whole separate language. Then there's Shanghainese, and that's a whole separate language. Then there are three that barely anybody who isn't a specialist or a native has ever heard of, called Hakka, Gan, and Xiang. Those all three are completely different. So those are the seven sort of Romance languages of China, so to speak. They all formed around the same time. And so they're all written with the same writing system, and so that gives them the impression of being the same language. And they're all spoken in China, which has a certain sense of cultural unity. So again, it's as if they're all the same, but they're nothing the same. So these are different languages that are spoken in China. Now, if you trace back one of their ancestral stages. And, of course, technically it's controversial whether Middle Chinese is all of their ancestral stage, but it's a useful and responsible shorthand. Middle Chinese's word for daughter-in-law was pronounced roughly shook. That was the word for daughter-in-law. For those of you who are experiencing this who are of Chinese descent, my accent in Chinese, I'm aware, is, shall we say, quaint, but I'm doing my best. So, Middle Chinese is shook. Now, here we are with modern Chinese, and that word, the descendant of that word, in Mandarin is qi. So from shook to qi. Doesn't really sound a whole lot like it, but that's what has happened. In Cantonese, it's sam. And so that's to give you an idea of what it sounds like when people talk about them being dialects. And so if the word in Mandarin is qi, and then another one, it's sam, is that dialect? You'd think dialect would be like qi and then qi, or something like that, like bad and bad. But we're talking about qi and sam. That's kind of like la femme and la mujer, almost. And so, very different things. And then,